Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on our weekly roundtable, the post-Labor Day presidential election crunch and panic is on. Hillary has had a bad spell. There's no let up from the email scandal and Benghazi. Now, even Colin Powell's opinion on both fronts are public due to his private emails being hacked. And the press have had a heyday with her comment that half of Trump's supporters were a basket of deplorables. That was then followed by Hillary's bout with pneumonia, giving legs to conservatives who for a while now have tried to make something out of Clinton's health, to some who even speculate that Clinton was poisoned by the Russians. But what does all this mean for Trump, the man that refuses to release his taxes and has insulted just about everybody, women, Mexicans? He's threatened not to allow Muslims into this country, regularly issues racist dog whistles, including refusing still to say that President Obama is a citizen of the United States. But he says good things about Russia's President Putin. Because, he says, Putin says good things about him. Is this the future of U.S. foreign policy under a Trump presidency? But what has happened to Hillary? Why is this race a dead heat, leaving many in the know quietly but seriously considering a Trump win? Why is Trump so popular among white voters? Is it about the state of the economy or is it about race? And why are young people flocking in numbers to conservative libertarian candidate Gary Johnson, and why is Green Party candidate Jill Stein behind Johnson in the polls? Also, fallout from Trump's visit to Mexico, the troubles of the Workers' Party in Brazil, and what are the implications of the latest peace accord in Syria brokered by the U.S. and Russia? Our panelists are Jackie Goldberg, Laura Carlson, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Donald Trump's campaign is declaring that the Republican presidential nominee now believes that President Obama was born in the U.S., though Trump has yet to say that himself. Yesterday, Trump would not acknowledge Obama's birthplace, declining to address the matter when asked by the Washington Post. Trump told the paper, "I'll answer that question at the right time. I just don't want to answer it yet." Hillary Clinton pounced on Trump's refusal during a speech last night before the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute.
Every time we think he's hit rock bottom, he sinks even lower. He was asked one more time, "Where was President Obama born?" And he still wouldn't say Hawaii. He still wouldn't say America.
Hours later, the Trump campaign spokesman Jason Miller issued a statement saying, after forcing Obama to release his birth certificate 5 years ago, Trump now believes Obama was born in the U.S. Trump repeatedly has said during the campaign he no longer talks about the birther issue, while refusing to retract his previous comments. The House Intelligence Committee has issued a scathing bipartisan report accusing former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden of leaking information that caused tremendous damage to U.S. national security, lying about his background, and feuding with coworkers. The House report says Snowden is not a whistleblower and that he was and remains a serial exaggerator and fabricator. The issuance of the House committee report coincides with the release of Snowden, a movie directed by Oliver Stone that portrays him as a hero for exposing the scope of massive worldwide U.S. surveillance programs. This week, the ACLU, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and others urged President Obama to pardon Snowden. ACLU attorney Ben Wisner, who represents Snowden, said the report's release a day before the Snowden film opens is evidence that people in the intelligence community are taking us seriously, that they're concerned that Oliver Stone's movie will help solidify Snowden's image as a true patriot, which he is. The young woman at the center of a police sex crime scandal is back in the San Francisco Bay Area and ready to testify against 7 law enforcement officials, including 5 Oakland police officers. The Alameda County District Attorney has filed charges including oral sex with a minor, misusing computer databases, and obstruction of justice. Several officers had sex with Jasmine Abuslin while she was an underage, sexually exploited minor, as young as 16. She's now 19 years old. Her attorney, Pamela Price, says instead of helping Abuslin flee her pimp, local police sexually exploited her.
When a young girl is running away from a pimp on the street or trying to flee a life of exploitation and violence and fear, she has to know that when she goes to a police officer, that he's not going to take her to the back of the police car, that he's not going to take her to a room, that he's not going to tell her about his buddy who's interested in having sex with her. That's not what we pay police officers to do.
Abuslin has said she had sex with 30 police officers and sheriff's deputies from agencies around the Bay Area and Northern California. The family of a 13-year-old Columbus, Ohio boy fatally shot by a police officer wants an independent probe. Police say Tyree King was a suspect in an armed robbery. Police say they shot him dead when he pulled a BB gun from his waistband and police mistook it for the real thing. The youngster's family said in a statement, numerous witness accounts are in direct conflict with the officer's version of events. The Kremlin says it's using its influence to try to ensure the Syrian army fully implements a shaky ceasefire agreement and that it hopes the U.S. will use its own influence with rebel groups it backs. The Kremlin comments came after being asked about Syrian rebel assertions that the army has not withdrawn from positions around the Castello Road, which leads into Aleppo, meaning that aid deliveries to the city were unable to start. The Syrian government has not yet provided permits allowing delivery of food and other humanitarian aid to civilians in Aleppo. UN humanitarian advisor Jan Eglin denounced the inaction.
Can well-fed, grown men please stop putting political, bureaucratic, and procedural roadblocks for brave humanitarian workers that are willing and able to go to serve women, children, wounded civilians in besieged and crossfire areas.
Russia has repeatedly blamed the U.S. for what it says is its reluctance to use its influence on some Syrian opposition units unwilling to stop fighting alongside the radical Jabhat Fateh al-Sham organization, formerly known as the Nusra Front. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And our weekly roundtable is back. We'd like to give a warm welcome to our panelists today. Jackie Goldberg, who served on the California State Assembly. She's also served on the Los Angeles City Council, as well as on the Los Angeles School Board, and later served as president of that school board. She's currently in contract with the mayor's office of Los Angeles in a plan called Service and Workforce Restoration. She's been an educator all of her life. Jackie Goldberg, welcome.
Thanks for inviting me.
Laura Carlson, political analyst and writer based in Mexico. She has written extensively on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration and gender issues in America's Update or Counterpunch, La Jornada, and others. She's a columnist for The Huffington Post, Foreign Policy in Focus, commentator in Al Jazeera, CCTV, CNN, and other outlets, including Mexican television and radio stations. She's co-editor of Confronting Globalization, Economic Integration, and Popular Resistance in Mexico, and has participated as both an analyst and an activist in the movement against militarization and the drug war on both sides of the border. Laura, welcome. I'm not hearing Laura. Can we give Laura another call and make sure that we have her on the line? I'd like to welcome Dr. Gerald Horn, who's the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, the Artist as Revolutionary. And he's done extensive research, as you could imagine, but his research and writings have addressed issues of racism in the areas of civil rights, labor politics, war, international relations, as well as the film industry. He received his PhD in history from Columbia, his JD from the University of California, that is his law degree, and his bachelor's degree from Princeton University. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Horn, there's something interesting, exciting coming up involving you and C-SPAN. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, on Sunday morning, October 2nd, 2016, I'll be at C-SPAN Studios in Washington spending 3 hours discussing my work. And those not listening to KPFK or other Pacific affiliates might want to tune in.
Right. Okay. Very good. Absolutely. Looking forward to that. And what we're going to do now is we'll play a few short clips. We're going to start out by discussing the election. First, let me give some poll information. According to an average of recent national polls from Real Clear Politics, in a four-way race between Clinton, Trump, Gary Johnson, and Jill Stein, Clinton's only ahead of Trump by 1.1%. And in key swing states, Trump is ahead by 0.7% in Florida, 1% in Ohio, 1.6% in Arizona, and 4.3% in Iowa. Clinton is ahead by 0.6% in North Carolina, 0.8% in Nevada, 3.5% in Virginia, and 5.2% in Michigan. We'll be talking a little later in the hour about the impact of third parties, but Trump gave a speech yesterday on the economy, pledging that he would create 25 million new jobs over the next decade. And says he'll pay for that agenda in part by making U.S. allies like Germany, Saudi Arabia, Japan, South Korea pay for the cost of the U.S. military defense supporting them. He also said he'd cut federal taxes by $4.4 trillion. That's less than his original plan of $10 trillion, and that he would get the country to 3.5% annual GDP growth over the next decade. But that plan is being met with skepticism among economists. Here's the New York Times says today that the U.S. is extremely unlikely to meet Trump's goals. They're saying that the Congressional Budget Office predicts 7 million more jobs in the next decade, not 25 million. And also getting those unemployment levels would either force people to retire later or require more immigrants to work in the U.S., which is at odds with Trump's plan to build the wall. Now, there's trouble on the independent front for Hillary Clinton. In Tuesday's NBC News poll, Trump was only 2 points behind Clinton in the independent vote. That's 38 to 36. So we'll see. And Trump has also been trying to court the Black and Latino vote. He's not having much headway there. He's winning only 4% of the Black vote. Clinton is at 91% of the Black vote. But nevertheless, Hillary is still struggling to kind of engage in and mobilize Black and Latino voters. So we'll see how all of that goes. Let's also, President Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton both spoke to the Congressional Hispanic Caucus yesterday to their gala event. And let's first, we'll hear a bit of what Hillary had to say, a bit of new polls for the third party candidates, and a bit of what President Obama had to say.
No one understands better than you the pivotal moment we're at right now, not just for Latinos, but for our country. My friends in the caucus have traveled to every battleground state, registered voters. You've stayed focused no matter what kind of outlandish and offensive comments we have heard from my opponent and his supporters. By the way, I personally think a taco truck on every corner sounds absolutely delicious. Whether your family just arrived or has been here since before the United States even existed, you're not strangers. You're not intruders. You're our neighbors, our colleagues, our friends, our families. You make our nation stronger, smarter, more creative. And I want you to know that I see you and I am with you everywhere I go. People tell me how concerned they are by the extreme policies and divisive rhetoric they've heard from my opponent, from the racist lie about Mexican immigrants that launched his presidential campaign, to his racist attacks on a federal judge. And every time we think he's hit rock bottom, he sinks even lower.
It appears third-party candidates in the 2016 presidential campaign take a slightly bigger chunk out of Hillary Clinton's support than Donald Trump's. That's according to the latest NBC News SurveyMonkey Weekly election tracking poll. Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson and Green Party candidate Jill Stein hold about 15% of the vote between them in a four-way race that includes Clinton and Trump. But when the third-party candidate's supporters are forced to choose between Democrat or Republican, they split for Clinton at a slightly higher rate than the GOP nominee.
If we're truly going to fix this broken system, then we're going to have to push back against bluster and falsehoods and promises of higher walls. We need a comprehensive solution that works for our families and our businesses, that grows our economy, that enhances our culture. We need an approach that upholds our tradition as a nation of immigrants and a nation of laws. And it is possible to do that. It's possible to insist on a lawful and orderly system while still seeing students and their hardworking parents not as criminals, not as rapists, but as families who came here for the same reasons that all immigrants came here, to work and to learn and to build a better life. And look, throughout this political season, you know, the talk around these issues has cut deeper than in years past. It's a little more personal. It's a little meaner, a little uglier. And folks are betting that if they can drive us far enough apart, and if they can put down enough of us because of where we come from or what we look like or what religion we practice, then that may pay off at the polls. But I'm telling you, that's a bet they're going to lose. We've seen this kind of ugliness and anger and vitriol before. That kind of politics sometimes may carry the day in the short term. I know that there are a lot of folks who have this notion of what the real America looks like, and somehow it only includes a few of us. But who's going to decide who the real America is? Who's to determine that in this nation of immigrants, in a nation where unless you are a Native American, you came here from someplace else, that you have a greater claim than anybody here? So we can't let that brand of politics win.
Well, a lot to get into there. We're still having trouble with Laura Carlson's phone line there. Jackie Goldberg, starting with you, one of the questions that we posed in our intro is what really happened with Hillary's campaign and why the race is at a dead heat. you know, why is Trump seemingly so popular? And even the basket of deplorables now, apparently there are a group of Trump supporters that are calling themselves Les Deplorables after Les Miserables, you know, and equating themselves with people in the French uprising, yeah, if you right. would believe this. Jackie.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you know, I think it was inevitable that that it would narrow. Remember, we're talking about two candidates, both of whom have very high unfavorables. Hillary's from 40 years of attacks against her. I mean, really, 40 years people have been attacking her. I mean, that's a very long time to be attacked. And she's made some gaffes. She's made some mistakes. But I think it's in part a reflection of the fact that as we get closer to the election, people are making decisions about who they're going to vote for. And while there seems to be a slight increase in Trump support, which is, I think, inevitable, now you have people who are worried about her health. You have this fake game that he played with Dr. Oz, in which he revealed nothing about his own health, although I will say the fact that he's taking aspirin daily makes me think he has a heart problem. Because they don't give aspirin daily to people who don't have heart problems anymore. So I think there's a lot of stuff that's still circulating. But I think that one of the things that has to happen is that Hillary has got to not only deal with the negatives, but she's got to be dealing with the positives. And she has to be seen as actively motivating her base to actually get more involved in this race. I think one of the things that happens when you're an early leader, as she was with so much, is people get complacent. And I don't mean money. The money's flowing great. I'm talking about people actually talking to their neighbors, walking precincts. She has a terrific network of get out the vote, which he does not. And I think that also will make a big difference actually on Election Day.
Yeah, and what about the looking at women voters, white women voters, Jackie? You see Trump at 46%, Hillary at 46%. And people are also wondering, is this so-named popularity of Trump about the state of the economy? Is it about race or likely a combination? What's your view on that point?
I think it's a little of each. I think she's doing, remember that Democrats in the last five or six elections lost white women. The fact that she's ahead with any group of white women is stunning. And she's way ahead with white women who have college degrees, which is a good part of the urban vote and suburban vote. So what you have is you have two Americas. You have rural America that never has recovered from the Great Recession. And that's a motivating factor for them to support Trump, because their view is that everybody who's ever been in political office before has let them down. On the other hand, incomes are up for people in urban and suburban areas, and so you see a much greater support amongst white women for Hillary in that area. I think there is still always a racial issue to all of this, because the fact of the matter is that Trump continues to incite the notion that somehow or another it's people of color, it's immigrants, it's foreigners, it's the stranger, it's the Muslim that is causing all the problems, and he can fix that. And he does it in a little bit more subtle ways now, but he's still continuing to do it. And I think as long as he continues to do that, he is going to affect particularly white voters in rural areas where an economic recovery really has not taken place since the Great Recession.
Right. And I think we do have Laura Carlson. Is Laura back on the line now? Laura, weighing in on this question on what you think has happened to Hillary, why the race is a dead heat. And, you know, a number of people, you know, who follow these things are now seriously considering a Trump win. The other thing, Laura, is that I did see Hillary speaking to the gala at the Latino Caucus, you know, their annual event yesterday. People were polite, but there was, you know, a certain lack of enthusiasm, I felt, in the response to her. In contrast, Obama spoke before Hillary, which might have been a mistake, you know, the same event, and they were extremely enthusiastic about Obama. Your take, Laura?
Yeah, I think what's surprising to me is that it's so close, and not just because Trump has been so offensive to huge sectors of voters in the United States, but the demographic surprises me. If he does have this core base that he's mobilized, and he does, along the lines of fairly extreme forms of race and sexism, it surprises me, and I think this has been the big surprise of the elections, that nucleus is as large as it is. And so just, you know, it has to go beyond just conservative, rural, white males, obviously, to reach the numbers that he's reached. And I think that continues to be somewhat of a mystery. In terms of the Latino vote, it does appear so far that there's a solid support for Hillary, but somewhat of a lack of enthusiasm. And that traces some of her policies in the past, especially if you look at the foreign policy in this region, and Honduras keeps coming up. So the big question in that sense will be how that vote is turned out. And there's extraordinary effort to be made in that sense to get what may be a less than enthusiastic voters to the polls. And I think it will really be an important factor.
Right. And Laura, by the way, you're cutting in and out a little bit. I know there's some technical issues, so just stay as close, you know, to the phone as you can there. But Laura, Trump made that famous visit to Mexico on August 31st, and there's been some fallout from that in Mexico. Of course, he returned and continued to slam Mexico, right? But tell us a bit about that reaction on the ground. And there are a couple of big things happening here in the U.S. right now. There is the indigenous huge fight happening at the Standing Rock Sioux, who've been battling a pipeline going through their territory. And also, there's been a national prisoner work stoppage that began on September 9th here in the U.S. But just on the Trump visit and perhaps Standing Rock, give us your thoughts.
Well, the Trump visit has been extremely costly to President Peña Nieto. He was forced to ask for the resignation of his Secretary of the Treasury, one of his closest advisors and friends, because this man was the one who advised Peña Nieto to invite Trump to Mexico. There was a march of some 10,000 people in Mexico City just yesterday calling for his resignation. And one of the reasons they gave was that he was a traitor to the country for having received Donald Trump here in Mexico. So it's been a political disaster for Peña Nieto because he essentially offered Donald Trump, one of the public, you know, most famous, obviously, Mexico haters and insulters in the world, a media platform here in Mexico, and treated him as a statesman, giving a real push, a boost to his campaign. And that has been heavily criticized here. And I think it helped Donald Trump. He went back, and as you mentioned, he continued to insult Mexico, to insist that Mexico would have to pay for the wall as soon as he got to Arizona, and gave his speech about illegal aliens basically being responsible for most violent crime in the country, something which is absolutely ridiculous. So that's had a tremendous amount of fallout and will probably continue to have fallout here. Now, the Standing Rock, the resistance in Standing Rock has also been a big issue for Mexico and for other countries, because it comes in this context of indigenous people leading the resistance against extractive industries, against land grabs, and against this whole wave of projects and mega projects that are taking land from them and intensifying mining operations, oil and petroleum exploitation, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of solidarity here. They see it as a sister struggle to what's going on in communities throughout Latin America. And there's Mexican and Latin American indigenous leaders that are up there now.
Right. And there's a film, actually, that's circulating in the U.S. when two worlds collide, about indigenous people fighting to protect their land, this time in Peru. It's quite something. That film, I just watched it, really riveting. So as you say, Laura Carlson, this struggle has wide implications throughout the Americas. Now, just to give, we're going to be bringing in Dr. Gerald Horn here. But again, looking at some polling, young Latinos do prefer Hillary to Trump. Last week, Latino Decisions poll found her 50 points ahead of Trump, with Latinos between the age of 18 and 39. But turnout, of course, is going to be key with this particular group. And some analysts are saying that young Latinos and millennials generally will turn off to the election and not vote, rather than having to show up to have a protest vote. And what that means is, according to a CBS News poll, 31% of, for example, of North Carolina's black voters are only supporting Clinton because they don't like Trump. And a Univision and Washington Post poll says 46% of Latinos in Florida and 49% of Latinos in Nevada believe that Clinton is a liar. And a recent New York Times report shows that Hillary is underperforming among young black voters in Ohio and Florida, which are two key battleground states. So, Dr. Horn, I mean, there's a lot of alarm among a number of people that we may be looking at a Donald Trump presidency. And Colin Powell coming out and basically criticizing Trump soundly, but also criticizing Clinton, hasn't helped any of this either.
Well, certainly there is an intriguing debate taking place within the U.S. mainstream about why there's so much white working class support for Donald J. Trump. In fact, the debate in the mainstream in many ways outstripped the debate on the U.S. left about this important matter. Roger Cohen in the New York Times just a few days ago went to Kentucky cold country and interviewed a number of people and came back with the conclusion that many of them are hostile to Obama. Many of them are hostile to his environmental policies, which they see as strangling the coal industry and driving down employment. The best-selling memoir by J.D. Vance, Hillbilly Elegy, downplays the question of racism in terms of the reaction to Obama and says it's because he appears to be so urbane and articulate and cosmopolitan. Even Fareed Zakaria of CNN and the Washington Post had to dismiss that particular bit of nonsense, pointing to the clear racism that is involved in the opposition to Obama. Certainly, deindustrialization plays a role, which has been a bipartisan policy. The Trans-Pacific Partnership apparently will get a vote in the lame duck session in December and may pass. But what people need to ask themselves is, why doesn't the black working class back Donald J. Trump, since they've been hit even harder by deindustrialization? If you look at the analyses of the U.S. left, they seem to spend more time downplaying white working class racism more so than attacking it. They parse the data and torture the numbers to the point where you would think the only whites voting for Donald J. Trump were Ivanka, Eric, and Donald Jr. They downplay the fact that 9 out of 10 whites in Dixie routinely back the GOP, which and that, of course, contains a goodly number of white working class voters. It's interesting to note that in some ways, the racist white working class vote has a better grip on U.S. history than the U.S. left, which tends to romanticize and glorify the history. I mean, for example, just the other day, the New York Times reviewed a book, Blood at the Root, about Forsyth County, Georgia, where the 19th century European settlers drove out Native Americans on the Trail of Tears. And then a century later, in 1912, they drove out all the blacks and then took and divided their property amongst them. When Donald J. Trump descended the staircase at Trump Towers in June 2015, announcing his run for the presidency, what riveted many of these voters was his attack on Mexicans, his desire to build a wall, which led them to think that he would favor them over, for example, Mexican-Americans and black Americans and others, which has been the historic tendency in U.S. history by U.S. ruling elites in this corrupt bargain with those who are not elite. In fact, Jonah Goldberg, the conservative columnist in the L.A. Times, it seems to me has a better grip on some of these issues than some of our friends on the left, because, of course, he's written at some length about what he calls white identity politics. The term identity politics is usually applied to those of us who object to black people being executed by officers of the state without due process of law. Similarly, I'm surprised there hasn't been more talk about Jesse Ventura, the governor of Minnesota, a pro wrestler, who in a sign of contempt by the mostly white electorate of that state was voted in as governor. You could include Arnold Schwarzenegger, the B actor, elected by the voters of California in that same kind of category. Now, with regard to Hillary Rodham Clinton and the Democrats, this playing up Donald J. Trump as an agent of Vladimir Putin, which has been the line from Paul Krugman, Nicholas Kristof, and Thomas Friedman, all in the New York Times, it seems to me is a loser. All it does is whip up right-wing sentiment. All it does is guarantee that if Hillary Rodham Clinton is elected, that there will be some confrontation with Moscow in the first few months of 2017, which would be a disaster. And in any case, Donald J. Trump's policy towards Moscow in many ways harks back to President Obama's pre-February 2014 policy, that is to say, before Crimea, where he wanted a reset with Moscow so he could pivot towards China. It seems that Hillary Rodham Clinton will be confronting Russia and China simultaneously, which would be disastrous. I should say, however, that the story in Newsweek on Donald J. Trump's economic interests all over the world and how it's going to be difficult to police and corral those investments, even if he puts them in a blind trust, is going to be a nightmare and presents all sorts of conflicts of interest. You are correct to point to the North Dakota struggle where Jill Stein of the Green Party was arrested. And you are also correct to point to the prison strike that took place. But I would also point to the fact that Colin Kaepernick, the San Francisco 49ers quarterback, who has refused to stand for the Star Spangled Banner, the national anthem, not least because of the racist lyrics embedded in the third stanza, has ignited a chain reaction where you see city councilmen in New York, state legislators in Missouri, women soccer players across the United States emulating Colin Kaepernick. And this bids fair to help to ignite a kind of radical consciousness that could ultimately save us all from disaster in 2017.
Thank you for that, Dr. Horn. Very comprehensive response there. Jackie Goldberg, I wondered if you had a quick comment, because the New York Times is reporting today that the Clinton campaign, they're sending Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren to campaign for Hillary in Ohio on Saturday. And of course, they're popular with many young third party voters. And there's a super PAC of Clintons that's going to be funneling millions of dollars to try to get non-Trump voters to vote for Hillary, a number of whom are young people. But, you know, there is a Gary Johnson issue, because a new Quinnipiac national poll among voters 34 and younger, Gary Johnson is only 2 points behind Hillary. And this guy's pretty conservative on a number of points, although he is anti-war and he is for legalization of marijuana. But, you know, there are a whole set of things that he's against that people should really pay attention to, because he's kind of conservative. So Jackie Goldberg, just a quick comment, because there is a problem with the independent vote and the third party vote, at least a problem for Hillary.
Well, I think that the fact that both parties are being seen as having failed the American public is one of the issues. And so some people, particularly young people, are looking for a way to protest the fact that nothing seems to get better from either party. And so what is happening with Gary Johnson is that they don't understand that the party he represents has a lot more in its platform than just legalizing marijuana and staying out of foreign entanglements and isolationism. And I think that if Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and a PAC can publicize what's actually in their platform, what that party stands for, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia that it is not just implied but stated in their platform, and the kinds of things that this reactionary group stands for, I think that it will scare people away. Now, whether or not it moves them then toward the Green Party or to Clinton depends in good part on, I think, the real efforts of people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, and I will say that for the Pacifica listener, are likely closer to a poll that was done by Common Dreams. And in that Common Dreams poll of their readers from September 7th through 9th. It showed 42% for Hillary Clinton, 36% for Jill Stein, and 11% a write-in for Bernie. So we'll see how all of this plays out here. We're going to take a short station break, and coming up, we're going to be talking about Syria and about some of the troubles of the Workers' Party in Brazil. We'll be right back.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
The great late John Lennon, Imagine. This is Margaret Prescott. Check out our archived shows and lots of other news and views on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you are a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the states of North and South Dakota, and a shout out especially to the Standing Rock Sioux, who are making a stand and protecting the land for us all. And it is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Jackie Goldberg, Laura Carlson, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We're now going to turn our attention for the rest of the hour to some international issues. We'll be talking about Syria and a bit also about what's happening in Brazil and a cause for concern there. But let us start out by just listening to a short clip now. There's been a peace agreement brokered by the U.S. and Russia in Syria. It seems to be taking hold. People are still waiting for Aleppo. By the way, Aleppo was when candidate Gary Johnson, when asked about Aleppo, he says, "What's that?" Right?
What's Aleppo?
Yeah, what's Aleppo? Anyway, they are still waiting to get the clearance for aid to come into people who have been suffering so much there as a result of that civil war. Let us go now to a clip on from Reuters on peace after ceasefire in Aleppo.
Children fill the streets of Aleppo, taking advantage of a rare peace.
The situation without war plans is making children happy, and they're having a good time. God willing, the situation will remain this way.
Thanks to the U.S.-Russia brokered ceasefire, the city has come tentatively back to life. It's the second attempt this year to halt the war, and no one knows how long it will last. But for now, residents and rebels alike are reveling in the peace.
It's as though we went back to our childhood, and we were experiencing our beautiful world during the ceasefire.
The city is also awaiting much-needed aid. It's expected to be delivered Friday, as long as the ceasefire can hold.
All righty. And that's a clip from Reuters. And Jackie Goldberg, starting with you, we know that more than 470,000 people, including women and children, have died a result of this conflict. We know that, you know, they don't seem to be any clean hands in this conflict. The U.S. position is that the Assad government must go. Russia is saying it's up to the Syrians to decide internally what is to happen to Assad. And meanwhile, Turkey, Al-Qaeda, the News for Front, IS, Iran also a key figure here, playing a lot of how things are playing out in Syria. But it does seem as though this may be some hope for this particular peace agreement. Just some quick thoughts from you, Jackie Goldberg.
Well, I think it's the first sort of little tiny ray of light we've seen in a very, very long time. The real question will be whether or not these convoys of trucks bringing food to 80,000 people can get get into Aleppo. If they can get into Aleppo, then we're seeing an actual possibility of some change for those people who have been virtually encaptured and bombed daily by the Syrian government. I mean, it's really a travesty, to say the very least. So I think that's the big question. I know that there is a lot in it for both Russia and the United States, as each of them has other fish to fry in the area besides this particular issue. And I think that Assad was particularly disgusting when he came out the other day and says, I'm going to conquer the whole country. I mean, that's really going to help get a ceasefire going. So there are a lot of difficulties, but I think that the UN humanitarian advisor, Eglin, said that he thinks that that both sides have been not doing too well. But on the other hand, it's better than it's been. And so what all we can do is hope is that both the United States and Russia can put enough pressure on everybody to let some much-needed relief into Aleppo, and that may move things a little bit closer to talking about some solution other than continuous war.
Yeah, and Laura Carlson, just I want to do a little pushback, Jackie, because I'm not quite sure that all of this can really be put on the doorstep of Assad, because after the protests, peaceful protests against Assad began, it very, very quickly turned into a proxy war in the United States, definitely pushing armed conflict against the Assad regime. But Laura Carlson, your take on this, and also, I want you to quickly take the opportunity to tell us a little bit about the troubles of the Workers' Party in Brazil, because the first woman president, Dilma Rousseff, removed from power, impeached over really nothing. Over nothing. And now they're going after Lula da Silva, her predecessor.
Well, on Syria, I think I totally agree with Jackie. And I think that really what's going to be critical here is keeping the focus on the humanitarian aspect. The fact that violence has gone down is extremely important because we are talking about, as you mentioned, almost 500,000 people killed, many civilians, many children, many women who are not combatants, obviously. And there's still the problem of getting the aid, but that's a major accomplishment. But we're fighting against a mentality that doesn't really value that. The lives that have been saved in just the days since the ceasefire started. If you look at the National Review, Kerry capitulates to Russia, typical headline, and they actually say straight out, reduction of violence is not the sole or even the principal objective in warfare. They really just don't care about the lives that are being lost. The geopolitical game that's being played is the most important thing for this much more, you know, patriarchal and war mentality. And it's probably the biggest threat to any kind of a peace deal in that area. Then moving to Brazil, what's happening there is that Lula, the former president who left office with an 83% approval rating from the Workers' Party, has now been charged with wrongdoing for the Petrobras bribery scandals. He has declared his innocence and his willingness to prove that innocence. Again, the actual links are very tenuous. They're claiming that he benefited from a contractor, a government contractor that remodeled a house in Sao Paulo that he says was not even his. And he's also been indicted for obstruction of justice in the past. The reason that they're going after Lula is because there's a tremendous amount of pressure to keep Temer, the interim president, from remaining in office until the end of 2018 when elections are scheduled. The people are demanding new elections as quickly as possible because of what they consider a coup and a travesty of democracy in impeaching the democratically elected president Dilma Rousseff on such very politicized charges. So if they can nail Lula, if the conservatives can nail Lula, then that would, a criminal conviction would keep him from running in the elections, whether they're put forward or whether they're held in 2018. And they really want to knock him out of the running because he's still, despite what happened to the Workers' Party in many polls could win those elections.
Right.
Meanwhile,
okay.
Temer is using this for neoliberal reforms, and so the whole future is at stake right now.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that, Laura. Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, clearly in Syria, the United States meddling tremendously, arming people who may be who were associated with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but clearly had to rely on Russia to get anything going. So I'm wondering if the U.S.-Russia Cold War has now moved from Syria to the U.S. presidential elections, whereas you mentioned earlier where Russia is accused of meddling. I mean, you could blame Putin, but a quick take on you on this situation in Syria.
Well, RT in Moscow hit the nail on the head when it had on its website just a day or two ago that there is a tragic irony that 15 years after the attack on New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, which was blamed on Al-Qaeda, the United States is partnering with Al-Qaeda forces in Syria, i.e. through the so-called al-Nusra Front. This is a product of the dysfunctional relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is about to hit a crisis since Congress has just inked a bill or passed a bill which will allow U.S. nationals to sue the Saudis for their alleged complicity in 9/11. The United States also just inked this $38 billion over 10-year aid package to Israel. But according to credible sources, all that does is allow Israel to leak U.S. technology to both Russia and China. So in some ways, what's happening in Syria is a political disaster, a product of incoherence. And worse than that, perhaps, is the fact that there is open warfare now between the State Department and the Pentagon over Syria policy. It is unclear how that's going to end up.
Right. Well, on that note, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. Another fascinating roundtable. I'd like to thank you, Jackie Goldberg, Laura Carlson, Dr. Gerald Horn. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, assistant producer, Stephanie Case. Mr. T is out, and we want to thank our engineer sitting in for today, Kiana Turner. Thank you so much, Kiana. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening.